What we are doing during these weeks, we've got these 3 weeks, and I want to take us into three stories that really give us some kind of added dimension about forgiveness. We started one last week, that was in John 5. We're going to go into another one this week that actually has you kind of roll back a couple of pages to John 4. So if you kind of want to start moving that direction, that's where we're going to be. And I want you to actually see these things in your Bibles. Okay, I want your the oil of your fingers on these pages. Okay, and you mark them and do whatever you do in yours. In fact, okay, now what was is yours the one that's that cool one? If that's not the one, it's this one. Yeah, you got the cool one. Okay, what do we got on four? Okay, John 4. Oh, I can't see this thing. Okay, how are we doing here? Are you guys there yet? John 4. Okay, just make your way there. I'm just checking things out while you're doing this thing. I'm giving you some time here. Okay, text. I'm getting it. Okay. Oh, wow. Yeah, you've been here. Cool. Okay. Well, you don't need to listen to that. Okay. Okay, let me. Well, some of you are probably I still hear pages going. So while you're figuring it out, I mean, look at the index, find it, whatever you have to do. Let me tell you this thing. I came across this years ago, so this has been out there a while, and I think it's true, but I don't know this. The guy that wrote Sherlock Holmes stories, okay, Arthur Conan Doyle. I don't know if you're okay. Anyway, back quite a ways. He was a guy that kind of like playing jokes on people. I mean, you like to do that, right? Okay, this guy is pretty good though. I don't know. Maybe after you hear what he did, maybe not so much so. But one of the things that he did at one point, apparently this is true, that he picked out nine of his closest friends, and he sent them a telegram. That's kind of like sending an email message now. Okay, it was the email of the time. Sent them this message. Simply read, "All is known, flee at once." You know, can you imagine getting that email message from one of your best friends that says, "All is known, flee at once"? The interesting thing is that within a few hours, all nine of these friends had left the country. Now, I don't know what went on in their minds or what their life was like, but somehow that was a significant enough message that as they thought about their life, they thought, "I am in deep trouble," and they took off. Okay, now I'm not sure how I haven't heard how the story got resolved though. I don't know how he found them and said, "Okay, hey, wait a minute, wait, no one knows anything," you know, and I'm not sure what they did to get back at him, because I'm sure they must have done something. But still, it's that idea. What would go on in your mind if you got an honest message from somebody that you know, a credible person, that says, everything about you is now known. In fact, it's been posted on the internet. Everything. Everything you have ever done, everything that has gone on inside your head, everything that you kind of wanted to do, all that stuff, if all that got put on some blog somewhere and everybody got sent there and said, "Hey, read all about it. It's all there." Man, what would that be like? What kinds of things would strike fear inside you concerning what could be said there? If everything genuinely, honestly was known, if your whole story was told in its entirety. Now just think about that for a moment. We are, I don't hear any pages, so either you're at John 4 or you gave up. One of the two, okay? Now, this account, let me kind of set the stage before we even read it. Now that you're there, you're kind of reading it, getting into it a little bit, and that's fine. You're getting ahead of me, and that's good. But let me kind of set the stage for this thing, physically, the stage. This account takes place in a little village called Sychar. Kind of sounds like psycho, but it's not. Sychar. S-Y-C-H-A-R, something like that, okay? Little village place. It's nowhere. Okay? In fact, if you were to find this place, you'd leave from Jerusalem and you go south, you go north About, 25, 30 miles. You'd travel this ridge route, that's kind of what it was called. And you'd come to this place where there's a fork in the road, literally a fork in the road. And that's why this place was even there. It's how it survived. The travelers would come through this place. And if you wanted to head out toward the sea, you'd take that turn. Otherwise, you'd continue north on this. A little village place. Near this place is, it's just out on the outskirts of it, is a place called Jacob's Well. It was known that way because it was put there by Jacob. Okay, I mean, he dug this well, and it was known for that. And it was kind of a little oasis type of place that was there. The village is surrounded with farmlands, and this account takes place kind of late summer, when the fields have grown, and that wheat that would have been grown around that area is actually kind of at that point where it kind of dries out. You know how that smells when grass dries in the heat? And we live in a place where you can smell that kind of thing. So that kind of gives you kind of a little feel for this place, and you'd see this oasis going up. In fact, if you were in Sychar and you kind of looked toward the west here, you would look up and you would see these two big hills. Now, they called them mountains, but where we live, we'd probably call them hills. These two hills, and they're a fascinating thing to look at because here they are right next to each other, and one of them is this lush green mountain type thing, okay? Trees on it, it's just this beautiful thing. Right next to it, it's a little swale. Right next to it is one, same size, and yet it's as dry and barren and rocky as you can get. It's a fascinating thing. You look at these two and you go, wow, what's this all about? They're called Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Now, if you went back into the Old Testament times, you'd find that these were, they play a significant role. At one point, Joshua, in fact, you can go back and just jot this down and do your own kind of looking at it. Joshua 8 talks about it, where God had instructed that whenever Israel came into this promised land, that one of the things that they were to do was to gather everybody on these two mountains. Okay? And you'd put half of them over on Gerizim's side, okay, the lush green side. You'd put the other half of them over on Ebal's side. And they were to do this kind of cool thing. As they were on either side, and the ark would be right in the center with the priests and that kind of stuff. And what they were supposed to do was the Gerizim side would shout out all the blessings of God and just start naming them off. Boom, boom, boom. And they'd shout them out. And then on the other side, kind of in between, they would shout out all the curses. In other words, here's the blessings of living in relationship with God. This is what it looks like. And then on the other side, they'd say, here's how it looks when life is all messed up. Okay? Here's the downside of things. Here's the way life falls apart. And they would shout back and forth all this stuff. And it was kind of like this big, event and a visual, audio-visual reminder of this is what it's all about. And in the middle here is where you're making your choice. Right here with this Ark of the Covenant, this central feature of worshiping God. Pretty cool event. Okay, that was kind of the history of these two mountains here. Now there's another feature that you drop into this thing, okay, to get the full picture of this thing. At one point, there was actually a temple that was built on the top of Mount Gerizim, the Mountain of Blessing. Okay? It was built by the Samaritans. Another little piece. Okay, we're still setting the story up. We're not even into the story yet. Okay, run with me on this. The Samaritans built this place. Now, the reason they did that is because the Samaritans were this kind of small group of people that were kind of outcasts. Okay, because you see what, at one point when the Assyrians had come in and evacuated everyone to Babylon, okay, the Babylonian captivity, those of you who kind of know your Bibles and all that kind of stuff, the people were taken out and taken to some other place. There were some people left behind. And the ones who were left behind, if you kind of go back and read about how this happened, those who were taken were the best, okay, the best looking people, the smartest people, the ones who were the coolest people, those were the ones taken out. So the ones that got left were the losers. Okay? I mean, that's, I hate to say that, but I mean, as the Babylonians looked around, they'd say, not so much. Okay? You can stay. Now that, you say, wait a minute, I want to go into captivity. I want to go with the cool guys, you know? No, you get to stay. That's fine. Okay? We don't need you. Okay, those are the people who got left. Now, it got worse because those who were left there, the Babylonians brought in some other people so that they started to intermingle and intermarry. And whenever the Jewish people came back to the land, they viewed these people as the ultimate expression of selling out. And so they weren't welcome to come to Jerusalem and worship. They weren't welcome in their midst. In fact, they'd spit when they walked by them. Because these people were identifiable because they had certain kind of characteristics that came from this intermarriage kind of stuff, and they had kind of developed their own way of dressing and all this kind of thing. Very identifiable. So because they couldn't go to Jerusalem, they built their own temple on the top. Now, by the time this story takes place, that temple has long since been destroyed, and there's only ruins up there. But it's part of the heritage of this whole thing. So here we are in this account now, and we pick it up in John 4. Okay. So that's kind of the setting. I want you to kind of visualize that, have those thoughts in your mind as we engage this right here. In John 4, starting in verse 3, it says that Jesus left Judea and went away again into Galilee. In other words, he's in the south, he's going up north into Galilee. And he had to pass through Samaria. That's in between the two. Okay, that's where this place is. So he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, being wearied from his journey, was sitting by the well. And it was about the sixth hour. Now it's in Jewish time, which means it's about noon, midday. So that sets the story up here. Now, as you go through the account, you start to read through this, there's basically two characters in this thing. There's Jesus, and then there's this woman. It's midday, it's hot, it's the end of summer. And I want you to picture this woman. She leaves the village of Sychar, and she's going to the well. This is where the water is. Why they didn't build the city there, I have no idea. But they didn't. It's about a half mile away. Most people would go either in the morning or in the evening when it's cool and get their water that they needed for the day. But this woman is on this dusty little trail, working her way through the wheat fields, going to the well. Hot. And as she's going along, I can kind of, and I've tried to get inside what's going on in this woman. I imagine as she's walking along, she has all sorts of thoughts going on inside her. Because you see, this is a woman that has just, her life is all messed up. It's just messed up. So here she is, shuffling along in the dust, all by herself. Probably up on her shoulder is an empty jug that she's going to fill with water. She's balancing that. And she's kind of, what a picture. This lonely person with an empty jug shuffling along in this. And probably as she's going along, she's thinking through what life could have been like and what it's not. Probably thinking through those failures again, because every day she has to relive them as she makes this trip. There's a reason why she has to go at this time. She is not welcome at the time that everybody else shows. Those other women in the village that would have gone out in the mornings and the evenings, they know what her life has been like. And with the little comments they would make and the looks they would give her and that little subtle turning of the back to her, there were all these ways that would have indicated you are not welcome here. We know about you. It's, you know, your life is out there, and even the things we don't know, we're imagining things about it as well. I imagine as she went along on that road there, she probably felt the guilt of her failures. She felt lonely. She probably felt betrayed, disappointed, all the ways that life had come apart for her. She probably felt a bit of anger and bitterness. My guess is she was probably, my guess is late 20s, early 30s. So you kind of picture this gal going along, rehearsing, thinking through again what life has been like. You know, memory is kind of an interesting thing for us. It's fascinating that God gave us that. It can be a blessing and a curse. I mean, you can remember these wonderful times in your life, and you know, that's kind of a fun thing. But you also remember all your failures. Remember those times when life came apart, when you did what was wrong or didn't do what was right, and all that stuff, you remember it. Back here, I don't know, maybe it was a year ago now, I came across an article about this gal. They wouldn't tell you her real name. They just call her AJ. She's a gal who has a memory that is phenomenal. I mean, more so than anybody they can track in history. In fact, they're studying her at Stanford out here, whatever direction that is. She can remember, she's 40 years old now, and she can remember every single day of her life since she was 8. Can you imagine that? They try and trick her all the time to find out if she's, you know, how does she do this thing? They'll say, okay, February 3rd, 2001. Okay, and she'll tell exactly what went on that day. Oh, you know? Okay, what happened on that day? No. Eat and sleep. Okay, yeah, okay. That's it. That's not the answer she's given, though. Okay? I mean, she can tell you everything. She'll walk you through the day. This is what I did. This is what I ate. Here's where, people I ran into. Here's what was going on in the news. I mean, everything. I mean, phenomenal thing. How would you like to have a memory like that? Yeah? In the interview with her, that was actually the one that I read, she says that it's this incredible blessing and an incredible curse. The blessing is she can remember all the wonderful things that have happened in her life. And she can relive them. She can just go back there and actually relive them again, detail by detail. So the curse is that every failure in my life is just as vivid. I can go back. She says sometimes I have no control over it. And I'll go back to some kind of failure in my life, and I relive every single piece of it down to the intense emotions and the pain and the struggle and all that goes with that thing, and I relive it again. Wow. I imagine this woman, as she's shuffling along, had not that kind of memory, but had those things coming back to mind. All those failures. Got some of those that come to your mind? Some of those that just dog you through life right now. Some of those that perhaps, maybe you're in the midst of some of those. I mean, you're kind of creating them right now. Not going there. But that's this woman. And as she works her way along this path, she comes probably around this last turn. You remember, the grain is up and stuff like that. So she probably doesn't see a whole lot except the oasis coming out here, the trees and stuff like that. And probably comes around this one last turn and looks ahead and sees what she doesn't expect. There's someone at the well. And as she approaches, she realizes it's not a woman, it's a man. And it's not a Samaritan, it's a Jew. And probably all the red flags start going up inside her. Probably slowed her pace down, wondering what's coming on this, and wondering, is there reason to fear? I imagine as she got close to the well here, she probably kept her head down and avoided any eye contact, and came and faced this well, about an 8-foot opening in this well. Big deal with the stone wall type of thing around it, probably worn down quite a bit from the age. Probably came and put that water pot down, kind of on there. and gaze down into this. And as she's doing that, she hears this person behind her speak. Would you give me some of your water? Would you give to me a drink? Now, it doesn't, you know, I can kind of read a bunch of stuff into it, just like you probably can too. I mean, and I'm good at that. I mean, I'm probably shooting off in all sorts of directions when I do this kind of thing. But just by the response that she gives, as you look at the account here, by the response that she gives, I wonder if there's a little bit of a bite in that, in the response that she gives. You know, Jesus comments, my emphasis, I think, probably is saying, would you give to me a drink? But her response seems to have a bit of a to it, a little edge. Because she comes back with kind of a in-your-face thing. How is it that you, being a Jew, would ask for a drink from me, a Samaritan? What? You know, kind of thing. I wonder if at that point she looked for the first time in his eyes and began to see, this is not what I expected. Jesus' response in this is an interesting thing, because as this interaction takes place, in verse 10, he says, you know, if you knew who you were talking to right now, I mean, if you had any idea who you were talking to and what I could give you, this conversation would take a whole new spin. If you had any idea who this was that you were engaging with, man, this would be a different story right now. And it starts to go that way. Because as you follow it out, he starts out talking about this the water thing, and then he's going to move into her personal life, and then he's going to move into spiritual things. And he's moving her along a route that allows her to come to a point where she actually confronts the truth about herself, where he leads her to this place. I think one of the observations that I have whenever I look at this account, and perhaps this is the place to drop in that first observation, and that is that when Jesus met this woman, he met her at a place where she was very much aware of her brokenness, where she felt the pain of what was going on in her life. I mean, she had just walked that half a mile in the heat and probably lived through this story one more time. And then as she's doing that, this is when she runs into Jesus. And I found this to be something that seems to be something that God does with all of us. I know He does it with me. Where God meets me in these places where I'm very much aware of just how broken I am. It's an interesting thing. And He does so here. And in doing so, starts out by starting to move the picture already. If you only knew who you were talking to. Now, as the story progresses here, you find Jesus leading her to a point where she actually does this thing where she confronts some truth about herself. Because as the story unfolds, he invites her to go get her husband. Kind of interesting. He doesn't say, you know, I know some things about you. I Googled you. You know, it all came up, you know. Instead, he just very graciously invites her to kind of engage him about life. He says, hey, go get your husband and come back. And as you look at the account there, she owns up. She says, well, you know, actually, I don't have a husband. And then Jesus begins, it says, to tell her story to her. He says, you're right. Let me tell you your story. You've had five husbands, so to speak. Who knows what the story is behind those? And he begins to unfold this story there and tell her some things. You know, he tells her whole story to her. And I imagine as he did so, he didn't do it in a way that was confrontive, like, man, you are one messed up person. Let me tell you just how messed up you are. Instead, he must have done so in a way that allowed her to, or that invited her to stay in with him. I mean, she could have just got up and left. But instead, somehow, I can almost picture her kind of slowly sitting down on the ground and looking face to face with him and hearing this story unfold. He knows my story. He's telling me everything. You know, it's interesting that the way we're put together, we really don't like to hear the truth about ourselves. We don't like to go there. We like to hear the best things about ourselves, but we avoid hearing those things that make us sound bad or look bad or feel bad. There have been several times where I have gone to traffic school. Have you ever done that? Have you gone to traffic school? No. You know, I have. I mean, there's a reason why you go to traffic school, and that, I mean, you don't say, "Gosh, I'd sure like to learn more about driving." It's more of a practical necessity. You know, it's one of those things like, okay, I can take one of those ticks off of my, you know, traffic record if I go, and therefore my insurance stays within a certain range, and so there have been those times where I've done this. Now, because I've gone to several, I kind of know how it works. Okay. Maybe you've gone more than once. Okay. Some people are honest here. Yes, I like this. This is good. Okay. But for me, each time, even though it was a different place and a different group of people, it was exactly the same. Went in and it unfolded the exact same way. And one of the things, each time, that the leader, teacher, whatever the person is in front would do, would be, he'd go around and he'd ask each person, okay, tell me why you're here. And it was, and each time, I'm the kind of person, I sit in the way in the back, okay? I mean, in traffic school, I have no idea why people sit in the front. It doesn't make sense. But I sit in the back, and so they start out in the front, and they say, okay, now tell me, okay, so why are you here in traffic school? Okay. Yeah, don't have to answer. but as you'd go through, it was interesting that in that entire room, and each time there would be like, you know, 20, 30 people, in the entire room, there was not a single guilty person in the room. It's fascinating. I mean, as you go through and they tell their story and they'd say, well, you know, it was a speed trap. I really wasn't. It was not fair. It was kind of like, you know, Paris the other day saying, it's not fair. I mean, that's what they, you know, they would do this. They'd say, it was a speed trap. It wasn't fair. I shouldn't be here. Okay. Or my speedometer didn't work. I mean, it was amazing how creative people would get as you'd go through this whole thing. As people would justify the idea that I shouldn't be here. I'm not guilty, you know, but I'm here. Okay, and okay, I'm not as far as the answer that I gave, you know, in each of those. I'm sure that my answer wasn't as honest as it could be either. But it kind of revealed something about us. We don't want to admit that something's wrong. That we're guilty, that somehow we have fallen short, and yeah, it's true. But Jesus, as he interacts with this woman here, he brings her to that point where she's hearing this about herself, and he's saying, and then this happened, right? Yeah. And then this happened. And then this happened. And this is the fallout from what happened. And he tells her whole story, apparently, here. And not just the little clip there that says, oh, by the way, you had five other, you know. But he tells the story. And he doesn't tell it in light of, I can't picture it because she's sitting there, and because of the impact it makes on her, it must not have been one that was a condemning story, where he was coming again and saying, and then you messed up again, didn't you? A loser. You know, he doesn't, you know, go through this thing and just beat on her in any way. Instead, you know, he's telling her her story and saying, yeah, and it's worse, isn't it? And then it's worse, and then it's worse. But somehow, in telling the story, he tells it in a way that he also puts himself in the picture. And says, yeah, I know, but that's why I'm here. I know that too. And I know that about you, and I know that about you, and I know that about you. And the very things that she had hoped that no one would ever know, those things that bring her the most pain and the most struggle in her life, actually become the very key that opens up her life to this person of the Savior. Powerful thing. You know, as long as those deep, dark secrets in our life remain those secrets in our life, they actually hold power over us. They become the things that drive us with guilt. Those are things that just kind of put the clamps on our life and cause us to withdraw from people and produce all that loneliness and guilt and anger and all those things that she experienced. And what Jesus is doing is actually giving her the key to release her from that. He's saying, I know these things. I already know. You don't have to have them as a secret. I know. And expressed it in a way that carried with it the grace and mercy of the person of who he is. If Jesus was to sit down and tell your story, what would that story be like? What kind of chapter titles would he give to him? What kinds of themes would run through your life as you told your story? I realize that some of you have a fairly short story so far. But I can assure you that as your story progresses, there'll be some pretty interesting pieces that show up. Okay, because that's how life works. And as God keeps engaging us, He keeps taking us deeper and deeper into telling us, this is what's true about you. This is who you really are. This is the truth of Steve Korch. This is the truth of David and Sue and whoever else is in this room. This is the truth about you. But does so in a way that actually engages us with Him. There was, back here, what year would that have been? Right after the freedom came to the former Soviet Union. I had a chance to hear a Romanian believer that just come out of Romania. I mean, right after that opportunity came to leave there. And it was fascinating to hear about it because he talked about just how intense that was for Christians in Romania. Talked about the kind of ministries they had and all that. But one of the things that stands out in hearing his story was he says, you know, there's a way that we describe ourselves there. He says, you here in this country, you call yourself believers. He says, actually, for us, that's kind of a wimpy term. He didn't say wimpy, but something like that. Okay, that's fine. It just simply says, yeah, this is what I think. You know, this is how I feel. This is what I believe. He says, we describe ourselves as repenters. Those who are continually learning new things about ourselves, confronting the truth about ourselves, and choosing to address that. That's an interesting thing. And that's really what Jesus is doing at this point. He's bringing her face to face with who she is. And it's an interesting thing that unfolds because as this whole story unfolds and she runs off, she has a testimony that she's running with. She runs back to Sychar, okay, leaves her pot, all that stuff, runs back to Sychar, to the village, and her story isn't this. It isn't, hey, I found this guy that did these miracles out there. That's not the story. She doesn't come back and say, you know, I found someone that told me all the prophecies of the future. She didn't say, get this, she didn't say, I found someone who told me all the things that other people did to me and told me I'm a victim and was so sorry for all the ways people had been mean to me. Didn't say that. Instead, she comes back with something that just fascinates me. She runs back and says, I ran into someone out here who told me my whole story. Who told me everything that I have done. All the crud in my life, everything that's... He told me the whole story. And somehow, in the midst of that, also presented himself as the one who has dealt with it, or will deal with it, as the Messiah himself. Because that's what he says. The one who is speaking to you is the one that you're seeking. Wow. What a statement. What's our statement like when we talk to other people, you know? I can't imagine me going out and saying, you know, I've been trying to engage this. Okay, now what would that look like in my life? But this idea of going out and saying, you know, I've encountered the person of Jesus and he told me all the junk in my life. You ought to come and see him. I mean, is that a compelling thing? Would you want to go out and say, you know, maybe that's not a good thing. You know, I'm not sure I want to sit down with someone who knows it all. I mean, knows my story, knows all the junk inside me. But somehow what she conveyed was such a compelling thing that everyone comes out of the city. They all come pouring out. She ran back and said, he told me everything. And somehow conveyed in that has also forgiven. And as you come more toward the close of this story, you know, everyone in the city comes out and you get down to verse 39. You know, she's gone in there and she tells them, okay, in verse 42, that's what I'm looking for. It says they were saying, you know, as they encounter Jesus, they say, no longer is it because of this woman's testimony that you told her everything about her life. You told her whole story. Now we believe. Apparently he started telling them their story. And what they believe is not that he's some cool prophet, but that he is indeed the Savior of the world. You see that? The fact that they were confronted with the reality about themselves and his grace and mercy and how that was addressed led them to the conclusion, this is the Savior. Now, here's my takeaway. I've tried to capture this in a fairly concise way, this account. But here's my personal takeaway. That as I confront the truth about myself, I experience the reality of my salvation. It's one thing for me to hear God, you know, God has forgiven you and like that, and kind of leave it as just a thought in my head. It has very little impact on me in reality. But as God takes me through this continual process in my life of showing more and more of my story, of confronting me with the truth of me, it wasn't just one point back here, but as he confronts me with the truth of who I am and the realities that are deep inside my heart, I find myself at a position where I can experience the reality of that salvation that I can only experience at that point. You know, one of those verses that we throw around a lot, 1 John 1:9, probably everybody in the room can quote that. That wasn't addressed to unbelievers. Wrote that to believers. That as we are willing to actually confess our sin, in other words, to own up to the realities about ourselves, the truth about ourselves, we experience the fact of our forgiveness. It becomes a reality for us. And only to that extent, as you know, as I deal with the things that are deeper and deeper inside my life, as God kind of exposes those things, that allows me to experience in deeper and more powerful ways just how forgiven I am. Now, let me leave you with one last thing. A couple years ago at the retreat, I think I used this story, but your memory doesn't go back 2 years, does it? CDC won't, you know. Mine doesn't. The only reason I know this is I went back and looked at what I talked about. So, and I've used this a number of times simply because it had such an impact on my thinking. It has to do with the singer Amy Grant. Okay. Blank stares. You know. Grant, you know. She's a singer. Okay. Okay, anyway, she during in some years back here, she's a very popular singer, but she went through some real crud in her life, which part of that showed up in terms of a divorce and a remarriage, but then there's all the little stuff that goes with that, and life just kind of came apart and was a mess. But what made it particularly interesting in her case was that it was all out there, okay? All is known type of thing. It was put out there. Everybody knew it. And she received all the kinds of responses that this woman kind of did. Okay, the rejection, the guilt, the loneliness, all this stuff that goes with it. And she, for a while there, for about a year's time, was just beat up every time, you know, she turned around. Not physically, but I mean, beat up. And there was this interview that took place kind of at the other side of all that. This is about 5 years ago now, this interview took place. And it was with the interviewer was not a Christian. So it wasn't kind of a setup thing. It was somebody that was just kind of, you know, CNN type person or something like that. And kind of walked through all the stuff that she had been through and got her to talk about just how horrible it was. And at the end of the interview, this gal asked Amy, "So Amy, after all you've been through now, all this junk is out there, and after all the shots people have taken at you and this mess, do you still have faith?" That's a pretty good question, huh? Do you still have faith? And her answer was, "Yes, I do. But it has grace all over it." Interesting way to put that. Yes, I do, but it has grace all over it. Our big statement, I think, to a world that is dry and looking for answers, trying to put life together when it's all broken and beat up, is that we've encountered someone who knows our story, knows everything about us. Everything. And in knowing that, has offered to us the thing that we long for most in life. We desire for that dryness inside to find water, the thirst for God to be filled. We desire for the dark secrets of our past to be forgiven. And we desire for the genuine possibility of living a life that is different. And that's exactly what Jesus offered to this woman. And what he offers to us. Those of us who know him, he still continues to tell our story. He says, "Yeah, you think you know it? Here's some more about you. This is the truth." And with each piece of that, we find ourselves able to experience just that much more of our forgiveness, the reality of it, to actually experience it and have it shape who we are. Let's pray together.